Welcome to Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath, just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment. And doing this intentionally can create that same magic. Our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. Now, before we begin, here's a word from our sponsor, Meditation for Leadership. We all feel it. The pressure to keep up, to perform, to push through. But lasting success doesn't come from speeding up. It comes from slowing down, leaning in, and creating the space to lead from within. That space is where we shift from autopilot to intention, building mindful habits that strengthen focus and calm. It's where we stay connected to our values and purpose, choosing to respond instead of react. It's where we unlock our potential to positively shape our own lives and empower others to grow and thrive. That's the work of Meditation for Leadership. If you're ready to create the space for sustainable success, visit meditationforleadership.org. Welcome. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'm the host of Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. And I'm honored to have as our guest today, Kyan Krippendorf, author of 6 books, founder of Outthinker, podcast host of Outthinkers, frequent contributor to Harvard Business Review and Fast Company, and a really interesting guy who I've done some work for behind the scenes, which is how we met. But Kyan, welcome, and thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me, Clayton.
I appreciate this. And, you know, we were talking before about a situation. It's like when I first got back in touch with you, you said, well, I'm dropping my son off at college in Philadelphia. And we went back to that conversation, and you said, you know, it was interesting because when he was in high school, before he went to college, a little bit concerned. He didn't know where he was headed, didn't know what his identity was. And as a parent, you're just naturally concerned to say, you know, has he found himself? When will he find himself? And he got to college, and lo and behold, bingo, this sort of arose and naturally, and you became very comfortable with that. And then we expanded that a little bit about, well, how did that show up for you in terms of this sense of identity? And then we can take that forward to be, how does that start to define the work that you do with Outthink?
Yeah. Yeah, I got to understand what the different views are on what identity is. I think it's really fascinating. And I think that most companies have identities. And in the work that I do with Outthinker and Outthink the Competition, one of the inquiries is, who are we as a company? Peter Drucker said, the definition of strategy is to answer the question, what business are we really in? And that it's always very difficult to answer that. What business are we in? And I think that there is this like deeper framing or understanding of identity that then shapes invisibly what options we see, and of those options, which ones we choose, you know? Yeah. And for my son, it was, I think that he, like many kids, was exploring what his identity is, but not proactively. But we had this ticking time clock of a way of college applications. And okay, you know, like I believe, like, you know, I mean, we should unfold on its own time, right? We all like will find our identity. But there was this November deadline, November 2023. And he had to at least choose a story for himself or something for college. Or he didn't, but the consequences would have been, you know, the way that college does admissions, they kind of look for people who are really into a thing or a few things, you know? And so, we thought it was sort of like, he did piano, but he stopped doing piano and started instead doing digital. We really made him do music. And then he said, I don't want to do piano anymore. He wanted to do digital music. So he did into composition. He was really into video games. He liked building computers from a fairly young age. He started building gaming computers. We kind of made him try all these different sports, and, you know, he was good, but he didn't really like, nothing caught. And it was, and then he did robotics when he was a junior, and they barely let him touch the robot. But then like senior year, it kind of all came together. Robotics, they realized that he was really good mechanically, and he designed a big part of the robot. Because of his video games, he was a really great driver. The coach of this team, who had been coaching for 15 years, said he'd never seen a driver as good as him. So now he gets pulled into this leadership role, and it kind of all comes together, right? The programming that he developed for his music kind of led into the robot, the building of the computers, the video gaming. It all came in, and then it fit into this accepted thing, which are these, I don't know if you've ever been to any of these robot competitions, but, you know, we fly to Atlanta, we fly to Nashville, and there's practically an arena, and there are thousands of people, and they're cheering, and these robots that are competing for these things. And he's one of the four people of this team of 30 that get to be not in the pit, but actually on the court. And he's there. And it kind of like all came together, you know, it's kind of like a dot matrix painting where you see the dots and then you don't see what it is. And then eventually and then you can't see anything else, because that's what it is, you know? So, that was really magical to see how it all came together. And then as he was writing his college stuff, I mean, we never got to read it. We didn't get to critique it, but we got to read it afterwards. And it was just like, wow, mind blowing, the stuff that he thinks about. He writes music and he posts it on Spotify and on Apple Music. He's got his handle, the Hazed is his name. And he, this complex kind of electronic music, and he keeps doing that, even though he doesn't get credit. He's not for a class or anything. This summer he built a robotic arm, a 3D printed robotic arm. And he spent hours and hours and hours on it, but not for a class, he's very like, he does it for intrinsic value. You know, my dad was a professor at Penn for a long time. And one of his passions was about the power of intrinsic motivation, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about Daniel Pink's book, Drive.
Right.
And the power of intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. So
yes.
Really, really cool. So I love that story of your son. And I love the passion hearing you talk about it. And it just makes me think about how that is, in so many respects, the manifestation of the work that you do in helping people identify the importance of identity and, you know, how are we defining ourselves, what definition is limiting, etc. So I'd love two things if I could. Mm-hmm. One is, you and I, you talked about early defining yourself as the dreamer. And I clearly see that. And then having to kind of shift and get mm-hmm. some new hats. So that, I'd love if you would to kind of talk about how that played out for you personally, but then let's hear about how this works into the consulting that you do with organizations and individuals at organizations.
Yeah. That dreamer identity, something my dad wrote, he's like, he said, like, in the morning, you might be a father cooking breakfast. Then later in the morning, you're a commuter in a city. And then later, you are a colleague. And then later, you're a professor. And then later, you're having lunch with a friend. You're a friend. So you have these different identities throughout the day, right? And you take one hat and put on the other, you know? So I think maybe there's different layers of identity. And what I came to realize for myself recently was that I had this identity that wasn't really helpful for me, given what I want to do now. And it felt like it was an identity that I how do I say it? You know, I think like when you try to push something away, I'm sure there's a Zen analogy to this, but you try to turn your back on something, then it wants to be seen more. You try to push something right. away, it's going to want to push back, you know? So right. if you try to like...
Resistance.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what I was going to say, it's like resistance creates persistence.
Yes. Resistance creates persistence. Yes. Yes. And so it's probably one of the Newtonian laws as well. So like there was this identity that wasn't helpful for me. I was like, but you know, like when you have an, anyway, you have an identity, you think that's really you, but you're not just that one identity. You have lots of, there's a book. Oh my God. What was it called? Man's Possible Evolution, Man's Possible Future Evolution. Little book. I found it in a bookstore once. And it was like written in 1920 or something like that. And there's this one diagram. It says, we think we look like this as a big picture of an I, like the letter I, but actually we are this I, lots of different eyes. And so I think that that's, so anyway, long story short, I don't want to talk about myself, but it's like, I had this identity. I was like, oh, this is a naive person who just dreams about stuff, who just writes books because they're interested, but doesn't think about the commercial value of it, who starts a project or a business, but it's not thinking about what the business model is. Like I can advise people and I can help people through my coaching. I can get these entrepreneurs who are good at execution, good at sales, good at marketing, good at organization, good at people, recruiting, details, finance, all that stuff that I'm not good at, but I can help them come up with an idea and then they can use all those things and turn those ideas into something financially successful, that's physical, that's in the world, you know, but I can't do that. But now I wanted to do that, you know? And so anyway, so I, through some coaching and stuff, I came to name it Kaihan the Dreamer. And once you name, and then I named it, I said, and it's not that I wasn't meant to be the dreamer. It's not the dreamer's not helpful to me, but now I also have other identities. Kaihan the Learner. A learner can learn sales. That was the first thing. I can learn sales. So I studied sales and kind of, and I got good enough at it. A learner can learn capital allocation, which is making logical decisions about where to invest and looking at ROI and EBITDA and things like that. A person can learn operations. And so, and now I'm learning marketing. So then the learner is a much more useful identity for me, because then it's not like I can do this and I can't do those other things, but I can learn this and learn this and learn this and this. And it doesn't mean I'm going to be great at any of them, but I can learn anything. And so now it is the learner and the dreamer together, you know? So that was, anyway, that was, I think, the dreamer, point. And I think we all have these identities that, we can have fun playing with, not deconstructing, but adding to, I would say.
Yeah. I love that. And I remember when we were first talking about that and you said Kaihan the Dreamer, and that wasn't enough. And I was thinking about, that really spoke to me, and realizing, you know, that I teach the growth mindset all the time,
right?
And fall into the trap of teaching it and believing it, and then, you know, not being able to change a light bulb in my house. And it's like, okay, wait a minute. You know, that's why God invented YouTube. It's like, you can learn, and getting over ourselves. And I think that fear of novelty, that fear of failure, the imposter syndrome, all those things that inhibit are taking chances. When we inhibit those, we're inhibiting our growth. We're inhibiting our ability to add to our skill set.
Yes.
And you and I both know, like, we add a skill. It's like, oh boy, you know, you get these waves of dopamine for that, right? So that kind of takes me into some of those, you know, the basic principles of Outthinker. And I love how you demonstrated that in your own life. But when you bring this into a company, so where do you begin and sort of how are you letting that unfold so that people can start to, you know, get their arms around, this is where we need to think differently.
Yeah. I think I don't usually use the word identity in my workshops because the context I do it in, I don't think that's as helpful, and it creates all kinds of like confusion. So I try to use kind of business terminology. But I think that in a way, what we do is we help people develop an organization or team develop a strategy, which is, I think, by helping them think through four elements of their identity. And they spell IDEA, imagine, dissect, expand, analyze. So I would be the imagine future, which speaks to who I am as a future possibility, which you could say is like my vision or my purpose. So you could say like, I'm a possibility of whatever. Martin Luther King was the possibility of people not being judged by the color of their skin, right? That is a great place. It's powerful. Being clear on that is a powerful source of identity. Dissect is kind of like breaking down a problem and what part of the problem you look at. And so you could be a person who is kind of a people person who thinks about building organizations. You could be a marketing person, someone who thinks about positioning messages. You could be an operations detailed person that's a person who builds the things. You kind of have these different areas that you tend to focus on in the problem. And that identity has you naturally go to that part of the problem, right? But being consciously choosing, hey, I'm a people person, but actually what we need right now is a pricing person. And so can I be that? Can I change my identity for that? Expand is really about expansion of your option set. And what I use there are narratives. So I think that we live in a narrative, is a deep narrative we live in. And then they're also, when we're solving a problem, we think it reminds us of another narrative. So one narrative is you get there first and you're the first one there. And because you're the first one there, you get to win. The narratives I use are about strategy. So it's usually about having defined your objective, what it is, how to achieve the objective. Another narrative is you let them get there first. And because they got there first and you got there second, you learn from them. And so then you win. Two inconsistent narratives, but we live in a narrative. And when one of them pays off for us, and this is like habits, right? When we do something, maybe at a young age and we got there first, and it worked, and then we got there again and it worked. And now we always want to get there first, you know? But we don't realize that we're living in a narrative. We're reliving this narrative. And then analyze, I think, is sort of like choosing what options to focus on. So I'm the kind of person who really goes for the lots of little small tactical things, and I build up the small things and that turns into the big thing. Or I'm the person who is really smart and I go for, I can see the low hanging fruit, the easy high impact things, and I clear everything out and I just focus on the one, you know. And then another one is the crazy idea. I'm the one that focuses on the really out there things. I let other people do the other stuff. I'm the one who goes for the moonshots, right? So I think that's also part of identity, you know? So if you kind of put those four together, IDEA, it both gives you a strategy, but I think it also then sort of defines your identity as an organization.
Oh, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot. And I also can see how that's not a process that most organizations will go through naturally, you know, without some prompts, without some help, because they're most usually trapped in whatever their historical identity has been, and or they have, you know, a leader who's got a vision and they want to take a different way, but they're not putting all these things together.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it takes energy and takes time. And so you got to kind of think like, okay, we could stop what we're doing now and we could look under all of these rocks to see if there's something better. You know, but that's a lot of lifting and a lot of time. And I got this one rock and there's something under this rock. Let's just keep going. Let's just keep digging underneath this rock. And there's this level of cognitive overload where the search for another alternative, you feel there's a point at which you feel like it's not worth it. Like I've always been this way. I'm never going to change. What's the point in changing?
Right.
You know,
it's taking us back to the fixed mindset, right?
Right.
And it's such a natural place to go because it, you're giving up, you're giving in, but it's like, whew, wow, that's a relief.
Yeah. Right? Yes.
You know, I don't have to save the world.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, I'm in the back of the bus, if, you know, taking the ride, and it's fine. Thank you very much.
Yes. But yes.
That doesn't fulfill us. And it doesn't change the narrative, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
I'm sure I read this somewhere, but it kind of makes sense to me that we're just trying to save energy. We're very efficient and it takes energy to rethink things. I mean, if you know, when you first get off a plane in a new place, and you notice everything, like what the signs say and which cars are driving on the left rather than the right, and how people are speaking. And it's just like it's sensory overload, right? And then you go back home and you recognize everything. That is to say, you recognize, you've already cognized it before. So it doesn't take much energy to recognize it. And so all of that attention now you can direct somewhere else, and you know our cognitive abilities are less than our ability to sense and the inputs that we're given, so we just could not operate if we didn't automate a lot of things and we didn't primarily operate subconsciously.
Right.
You know.
Right. No, and I really love that example of you hopping off a plane and now you're in a new country with new culture, maybe new language. And, you know, your system goes into overload processing this and trying, okay, this is new. So part of you, there's a pushback, mm-hmm. which is, whew, but there's also part of you, which is intrigued because this is different. Mm-hmm. And okay. And I just learned how to say, take me to the hotel in a different language. It's like, and they listened to me. Mm-hmm. That was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Right. But that sense of like, okay, that was exciting. That was expanding. We go back home and the brain goes, okay, shift. We're going back into save mode. And that concept, Kyan, I think is so important for people to recognize that the brain conserves energy. It wants the easy way. It wants, let's solve this quickly because we have to save our energy for the really big decision, mm-hmm. right? And we miss so much when we do that.
Yep.
And it also causes us to react as opposed to respond, et cetera. And
yes,
you know, for me, yeah. Right. And so I know, you know, we talked a little bit, in prep for this conversation today about you've meditated, you know, the concept of mindfulness, and you know, our discussion today is an expansion of mindfulness in real time. It's like, we're not talking about Kyan going into a Fortune 500 company and saying, you guys really should create a meditation module so you can do these concepts. On the other hand,
yeah.
There are elements of mindfulness in so much of what you do.
Yes.
And I just, I wondered, a couple things came to mind. It's like, you know, your focus on heightened awareness, right? Mm-hmm. And how important that is. Could you tie that into sort of a mindful concept?
I think that one thing that meditation helps us all develop is some, say, control of our mind, right? To be aware of at least the monkey mind and to then separate ourselves from it. And in business strategy, I think that there are at least two places where not having control of where our mind goes is a problem. One is in the practice of mental time travel, which is ability that humans have that very few animals have, the ability to mentally transport yourself into the future. And that is an ability that I think is really essential to any kind of strategy. Great chess players think many moves out, for example. innovators can often, like, just at least whether they can predict it or not, they can hold their mind, imagine this future. I think that, like, science fiction writers, I would love to be in the writer's room of, like, Star Trek or something. And, like, they probably are having conversations about 2000 years in the future and the combination of all these different things and how they would come together if you had this technology with that and then social and then this political and kind of piecing that picture together. So that's one. I think the other one is the sitting with an idea that initially seems impossible. Albert Einstein said, it's not that I'm so smart, it's that I stay with problems longer. Mm-hmm. So the staying with a problem that's easy to just put on the back burner, because with any new problem, you can come up with 10 reasons why it won't work. But to sit with those things and say, these are 10 additional problems we have to solve to make this idea work, that takes a lot of control, you know? So even in just those two places, I think that meditation gives you the power or skill or habit or whatever that is, that is critical if you are to be someone who is going to innovate the future.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the sense of the mindfulness element of the time travel. And by the way, it's like time travel in our brains is often a problem, right? If we need to be in the moment and we're thinking our brain is taking us backwards and we're just ruminating on what happened last week, or we're concerned and anxious and freaked out about the future, that's a different thing. But that ability, as you said, and I love the concept of visualization, mm-hmm. right? And I was taught through teachers of neuroscience that visualization is creating a future memory.
Mm.
Right? So once you've actually sat, and meditation is a really wonderful way to do a visualization, and you've taken yourself, you've done the time travel, say, here I am, here's where I will be, and maybe here's how I've overcome these obstacles, right? But you visualized the end result in the portfolio your brain carries with it to kind of say, what can we do, what we can't do? It's like, oh, I've done that. Mm-hmm. So that plays right into what you're saying.
Right. I see what you're saying. You recognize it because you've seen it.
You recognize it and you've taken the time to go through that process. And the more detail you can bring into that visualization,
yes,
the more the brain will accept this as
yes. And I think and the visualization is probably multisensory, because it's also, you know, what it smells like and what it feels like, and feels like tactily, but also feels like emotionally. I think that kind of anchoring us to that emotional higher order, but different dimensional visualization, which is not visual. I think that's also a very powerful tool. You know, just like breathing is a tool to get present, or smell is a tool to get present. Feeling, I think, is a really powerful tool.
100%. And I want to come back to that. You mentioned emotion.
Yeah.
Because as I understand the workings of memory in the brain, emotion has a huge impact on what is accessible. Over the long term, mm-hmm. Things that tie into an emotional event get carried with us a lot longer and are a lot more retrievable mm-hmm. than things that aren't. So that just, to me, underscores the importance. Also, the other senses you mentioned, all of that plays in. That to me is...
And just to link it to business, I think that at least two places, that's very an important trick or tool or awareness is on the branding side and on the leadership side. So like if you're a leader and your people can visualize what the vision, but then they can also feel it, having achieved of, you know, I had one friend that was a professional rugby player, And he would say, but before the match, they would meditate and they would visualize the whole game playing out play by play until victory. And then they would kind of be emotionally attached to that victory, you know? And then on the branding side, if you look at really powerful brands, I think that they connect with the consumer, not at a functional level. Oh, these headphones sound better than these headphones. But at the emotional level, oh, when you put these headphones on, you are going to be like lost in your music. And then at the identity level, if you use these headphones, then you are this kind of person, a sense of belonging and identity. You know, like the Beats by Dr. Dre, for example, is an example of such an emotional, cultural identity brand, you know, whereas there were other Bose speak headphones were probably technically better, but they didn't appeal at that higher order.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's getting in touch with how that lands.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And probably the folks who created those, you know, was it Dr. Dre? Was that the Beats?
Beats, uh-huh.
Yeah. And coming up with that concept, stepping away from how things should be marketed, you know, technical improvements and superiority, et cetera. It's like, yeah, we want this to be really, really good, but we want them to identify with this. Right?
Right.
Right. And I'm thinking of Michael Jordan, Air Jordan.
That's what I was thinking. Like, Nike almost never shows its products on its commercials. They don't talk about the whatever the technology in them and the bounce that it will give, whatever that is, right? It's whatever. It's the emotion. It's the purpose. It's the And they're a very, very valuable brand.
Yeah. And so I'm thinking as we pull this into sort of, okay, so Clayton's world of mindfulness in real time, it's like, okay, so the folks who come up with these marketing plans, there's an ability to navigate away from what seems to be a plethora of facts and this is what, you know, people should react to, and then kind of get centered and say, but wait a minute, you know, and somewhere in the focus group or whatever, they've been able to say, this is what resonates. This is, this is what people feel. Yeah. And I think that if someone in that branding operation hasn't done that, I mean, yes, intellectually, there's a lot of stuff there, but if you haven't somehow felt it yourself, you're not going to believe it.
Unless maybe it's you felt it somewhere else.
It could be.
Right. But I do think like in this, all this talk about AI adoption, and I do a lot of like podcasts and we talk to, and we have experts come and talk to our people about it, is what I'm hearing over and over again is that it's not about figuring it out and then doing it. It is about just getting comfortable with starting with AI with every job that you do. And seeing, is there a tool out there? But in order to get comfortable doing that, it's almost like you have to have this emotional experience where I asked the AI to do something that I thought it couldn't do, and it did it. Or I asked it a question that I didn't think it could answer, and oh my gosh, it answered the question really beautifully. And now it is that emotional, whatever, connection or binding or whatever, that then has you turn to it again.
Yeah, I will share that I'm a perfect example of that and have turned to AI for a number of different things to support the work that I do, because I'm a one-man shop and I'm pulled in 1,000 different directions. And when I'm writing my weekly blog, it's like for 5 years, I would spend a couple of days doing it. And I think it's pretty good. And I got good feedback on it, which is why I kept doing it. But what I've modified is I went back to AI and I said, here's 5 years of the stuff I've done. What have I missed?
Hmm.
you know, you've gotten to know my voice. I don't want you to write this for me, but I want your suggestions as like, what topics mm-hmm. in mindfulness in real time have I yes. Underexposed? And boom, 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 boom. And I'm like, yeah. whoa. And so getting comfortable with that would have taken me, I don't know how many to figure out. And then, but not relying and saying, okay, now just do it for me. Mm-hmm. I don't mind getting ideas and I will do that. Mm-hmm. But I want to be the owner of this. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think, a mindfulness around what do I need? How is this serving me?
Yeah.
Is this serving me in a way that makes me feel I've got my integrity, you know? Because by the way, there's nothing wrong if I'm saying I'm giving you something that I've, you know, co-produced with ChatGPT, as long as I'm honest about mm-hmm. it. But being mindful about where is it supporting me?
Yes.
And then, you know, what more could I use? I love that though. So like being, and I think that goes back to your sense of, you know, seeking novelty. It's like, and being open-minded about it.
I think, and I think how you think to use AI or ChatGPT or other forms, and your acceptance of it, I think there's also like a deeper metaphor of what it is. And so is it a tool you have control over, you can pick out and put away? Is it a companion? I kind of use it a lot as a thought partner, and I just turn it on voice and I just talk to it and ask questions. We go back and forth, and because I don't have that person, it's almost like my writer's room. Once a week, I have a writer's room session with my team, but now I can do it anytime. Another metaphor is it's a parent, and it's going to be taking care of us humans. And what we're doing right now is we are training it just like a parent would train a child, giving it its values and things to take care of us later. Then there's, of course, the, you know, it's an alien intelligence who's come down. But that metaphor, I think the underlying metaphor, which is carried by the language, it creates the reality for us. And so I think that the different people, when we talk about it, we're talking about from different metaphors, and maybe that's why some people react and some people lean in, you know?
You mentioned using your AI as a collaborator. And in fact, that's what I do. And I refer to it when I open it, I say, you know, good morning, dear collaborator.
Yes.
I asked it at one point, how would you like me to, you know, refer to you? You know, I'd like to be able to call you a name, blah, blah, blah. And it came back and it said, that's okay. And it started calling me Sage.
Well, let's go back to identity there. I think we did this session and this one of our members was talking about how she prompts. And what she said is, she tells it who it is. So like, I've been doing this, like I'm doing some research on some companies and I say, you are a top Wall Street analyst. Tell me about this company. And it will take that identity and do the work that a analyst would do, you know? Or you are an outstanding storyteller. You're Michael Lewis. How would you start? How do you start this story? So you can prompt it to adapt an identity.
Right.
It's crazy.
Right. And I think there's a lot of power in that. Again, it's like, well, you're doing the prompting. So you're still in control. And you're telling your collaborator, whatever your AI teammate, so to speak, this is your role here. Mm-hmm. Right. And interestingly, I think what we've found is that the more you go back and the more information you get, and you get, that was good, but I need this. Bah, bah, bah. Oh, okay. Bah, 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 right. And so you're able to further refine. And I think that, again, bringing this into my, you know, mindfulness in real time world, it's like, again, it's being in touch with how is this serving me? Mm-hmm. right? And do I sense heightened abilities to do what I want to do, freeing time up, getting different ideas that I didn't have before? Mm-hmm. Do I notice maybe being aware of the fact that sometimes maybe I've gone down a route that I wouldn't have otherwise, and maybe that's not my choice. Okay, be mindful about that. Feel it. Do you feel some disconnect in there? So stay present mm-hmm. with this, mm-hmm. 100%. Be wary. But as you said, if you lean in with an open mind and being present about what's coming out and what you need, you can be wonderfully surprised. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep. Yep. I think also when you marry what you need, or when you know what your, say, goal or outcome or intention or purpose is, right? Just like with ChatGPT, you can evoke an identity. I think you can do that for yourself. I think it's like powerful to say, who is the person who, if I place them where I am here right now in this step on the timeline, that they would have the outcome? Is it the brave person? Is it the clever person? Is it the compassionate person? Is it the motivating person? You know, and then you can like work backward from there and kind of figure out which identity you choose to take. If you are open to accepting that you don't have one identity, that makes it easier. Right.
Yeah. And I like to think of it as, of course, you know, in the pure Buddhist tradition, there's no self. But that being said, I'm going to take the Dan Harris approach, which is, it's a contradiction in terms. We are a self, but we're not a self. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I like to think of the mosaic. Mm-hmm. I like to think of the soup, whatever analogy fits for you, that we are a million different things. And I love your attention to, so what's needed now? Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm a mosaic. Mm-hmm. And if we take the perspective looking back at the wall, there's like a million little marbles or whatever, crystals. And then let's zoom in. We need this.
Yes.
We need this. And right. And our ability to understand that we can do that, but it takes intention, and it takes the ability to recognize that these are components of ourselves.
Yes.
So how do we do that, right? How do we recognize yes. those components?
I think it's easier to do when you identify yourself as the outcome. I think, you know, say going back to Martin Luther King or Gandhi had a very clear self. He was the possibility that Britain would just walk out of India. Right? Very authentically. And I bet he could choose lots of different identities. I don't know, but you know, choosing a different identity for the in service of that is feels mm-hmm. authentic. Choosing an identity just because I can get ice cream now, or I can make $50 more right now, like that, then your identity is ice cream or $50. But when you have that long-term purpose, I think it gives you the power to be authentic and yet flexible in your identity.
I'm thinking a couple of things because I'm right on board with you here. I'm thinking the identity of the outcome, and I'm thinking a couple of things. I'm thinking Judson Brewer. And his work with the craving mind, uh-huh. okay, and helping people out of addiction, and basically the identity being, you know, it's like I'm not a smoker, I'm not a drinker, I'm not a. So let's take this back. It's like the identity isn't I'm an alcoholic. The identity is I'm a person who has issues with alcohol. Okay, that means that I can be other things as well. Right. And I'm working towards being someone who doesn't have that issue, or that issue may always exist, but I'm working towards being someone you know, who is able to function better in, right, because I've made these decisions. But let's go back also to habits. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking atomic habits, and I'm thinking, again, identifying with, like, losing weight, mm-hmm. right? It's like, well, I'm someone who exercises. I'm someone who's conscious of my health, mm-hmm. right? And I want to lose weight. I want to be in better shape, but it's not like I'm a gym rat, but rather I'm someone who has, you know, a 360 view of how this affects me and makes me a better person and, you know, a longer lifespan, et cetera, et cetera. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like easier to, it's easier to, because we have limited short-term working memory. We can remember 7 ± 2 things at once. So we got a lot of other things we have to be remembering. What time do I have to pick up lunch and what time is my kid coming home? And so like to hold on to one identity is much easier kind of grasping point or an entry point than saying, I'm the kind of person who eats 1800 calories a day, works out for 45 minutes and primarily eats fish and vegetables. That's three things, right? But if you are the identity of I live a healthy life, right? That's a much, much easier access point. And then do what's natural. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. I definitely endorse that. And it's, I'm trying to work on that personally. But again, it comes back to, for me, if I'm in the flow of, and this is my personal journey, so I don't expect that everybody has time to meditate every day or the inclination. That's mm-hmm. right. And I want to go into some more discussion with you about other ways to kind of be present, right, besides meditating. But for me, try to make that, not only try, I do. I commit every single day some point. And what it does is it helps me more and more realize what it's like, I've just made a series of really bad decisions. Mm-hmm. It's like, I haven't been true. Let's go back. Let's set the intention today of this is what my day is going to look like.
Yes.
Maybe at the beginning of the week, this is what my week's going to, gets back to what you were saying about being outcome oriented. It's the process.
Yes.
Right. But thinking about this is where I'd like to go, setting the GPS at least.
Yes.
Right. So we're not so fixated on results. But we say, this is where we're headed, right?
Right.
This is where we're headed. And if we're true along this and watching the steps we're taking along the path, better things happen.
Yeah.
And we can correct this.
Right. And if we can detach ourselves from having consistency in the steps along the path, it gives us freedom, right? Like Miyamoto Musashi wrote the Book of Five Rings as a samurai, and he had this term like coming new. Like you're in the middle of battle and you're tired and you're hurt and you just pretend that you just got there. Boom. Mm. From up. So, and that I think is also like being present, that like what just happened, there's a break between, and you just got here and now you just got here and now you just got here. And if you could live like that, you know, you'll never get tired. And detaching yourself from the need to create an externally recognized consistency in the timeline, it now frees you to make different choices and have different outcomes.
Yeah. And begin again.
Yeah, right? Begin again. Yes.
Begin again. I mean, that to me is one, I know it's perhaps a catchphrase, but it's so to me fundamental, because at the end of the day, I'm a fuck up. Mm-hmm. I'm a delightful, somewhat talented fuck up, mm-hmm. but I'm doing it less and I'm having more fun with it because I'm giving myself grace to say, oh, there we go. And I know the more that I'm conscious of that, the fewer times it happens and I can rejoice in that. Mm-hmm. But also know every time the toothpaste is out of the tube, I can't put it back in the tube, but I can find somewhere else to store it and use it. Uh-huh. But it makes me think that the people that you work with, are so fortunate because they've got this experienced person who understands mindfulness, who's meditated in his life. We talked earlier, not today, but in a previous conversation about Stoicism mm-hmm. and using the foundations of the Stoic mentality, and then also this really strong understanding of how business works, mm-hmm. and that's, if not unique, it's pretty rare, and I think there's beauty in that, and I think that. You've seen people adapt your principles, and the changes that happen in organizations must be so much fun for you to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, that Zen koan that the younger monk asks the older monk, what's Zen? And the older monk says, well, it's like pointing at the moon. I could tell you what it is. I'm pointing at the moon, but you are going to confuse my finger for the moon. So I can tell you what it is, but it's not the words that are the Zen. It is what the words are pointing at, you know? And so I think that what is helpful in my application of mindfulness in business is that I don't use words that are part of the vocabulary that people associate with mindfulness. I use words that are associated with business, but I think they point at the same thing, you know?
They absolutely do.
Yeah.
They absolutely do. And that was one of the things that really motivated me to have this conversation is that, having produced your training, mm-hmm. And watched you at work and going, man, this is a brilliant guy. And he has a wonderful way of delivering this, connecting with people, explaining things in a way that is accessible without talking down to people. It's like, so, and that was years ago.
Yeah.
So you can see the impact it had on me that all, 7-8 years later, I'm like, yeah. I want to have a conversation with him. And I didn't know at that time until we talked later, it's like that you did have a background that you knew, you had meditated, you knew a lot about that world, yeah. And it's not something that you necessarily practice now,
yeah.
But you appreciate it.
Yeah.
And you appreciate the principles.
Yeah, I think maybe I'll get you a copy. It's the book that I liked the most writing, but that the least people have read. It's called The Way of Innovation. And, there are all these different frameworks like the S curve and different kind of frameworks for innovation. But I think that there is an ancient Taoist framework that I think explains the path of innovation: metal, water, wood, fire, earth. And metal is the realization that you're stuck. Water is the creation of the possibility. Wood is the beginning of the formation of the things before it's really whole. Fire is when the thing takes off, and earth is when it stabilizes. And then from earth, you go back to metal and you destroy what was stable, So I think you could take, and so, I still don't yet have the audience to be able to put that out, but eventually I want to put that out.
I love that. You can see the expression on my face. So before we wrap up, and I've loved the time we've had together, is there anything that we didn't cover that would be sort of important for you just to share?
I would just say, I think, if we've covered more than I thought we would. This is amazing. But this concept of the fourth option, I think, also aligns here. I use the fourth option to symbolize as the point at which others stop thinking. And that three is sort of a magic number in certain religions. Three is magic. And in geometry, three is strong, and great orders repeat in threes. And so I think that there is this, what stops us from wanting to put the energy in to consider, go through that cognitive barrier to think about the other thing, is that our three options make us, it feels complete. It feels like that's everything. And in our desire to want to reach a conclusion, to want to narrow things down, we just start considering what's already in view, you know? And so another way to think of it is like consciousness allows us to recognize where we've stopped thinking. We've gotten automatic. And say, okay, if people have stopped thinking here, then there's something that they're not seeing. And if I stop and I think, I'll see something they don't see.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we will put in the show notes links to your books, some articles, the links to stuff you've contributed to HBR and Fast Company, awesome. And also to your website.
Great.
I've seen your work firsthand, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's just really powerful. So, Kyan, thank you so much for our time together. Good luck in your future pursuits, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been great collaborating with you over the years, and thank you for including me here.
As always, I want to thank our guests today for sharing their stories, as well as my producer, Mary Ann Sanders, for all her work behind the scenes. And finally, for the support of my friends at Meditation for Leadership through their sponsorship. Until next time, this is Clayton Platt reminding you to look for those moments of magic in your life that lead to mindfulness in real time.